So this is the second of a four-part series. Last week we did Sefer Yonah, and I want to just review the literary points we made last week so that will start to come together as part of the book. The point we made last week is that in contrast to the division of Sefer Yonah and Tehillim, really the way in which Sefer Yonah should be divided is with the key to understanding the book is understanding the poem. Understand what goes on in the poem. That covers the whole narrative. That's the basic literary claim I made last week. So this week we're doing a book with, in some sense, a simpler structure, in that everyone acknowledges that Sefer Iyov is a prose story framing a poetic dialogue. Right? Nobody argues that the poetry was just put in by accident or because they needed to fill a slot. Everybody understands that the poetry matters in Sefer Iyov. However, the academics, in their general fashion, have presumed that the same person could not write the poetry and the prose. They've presumed this, on the one hand, on the basis of historical evidence, and it happens that Sefer Iyov is my favorite example for making fun of historical language, in that it was originally claimed that Sefer Iyov must be very early because it had Aramaic influence. It was late because it had Aramaic influence. And then somebody came up with the ingenious idea that if there was Aramaic influence early, there was Aramaic influence late, it is likely that there was Aramaic influence somewhere in the middle, and in fact, Aramaic tells us absolutely nothing about how to date a book in Tanakh. I endorse this conclusion heartily. In general, I tend to be deeply suspicious of attempts to date things by a linguistic phenomenon. And again, you know, I understand this is unfair, but but it's a polemic game. So my usual way of saying it is: imagine if what survived of 20th century English literature were one book by Joyce, one book by Hemingway, and one book by the fellow who wrote the Napoleonic War, Patrick O'Brien, and you had to construct the grammar of 20th century English from those three books, and you had to date things. And the date things based on it. And we have no way of knowing that what we have in Tanakh is any different. Even assuming that any of our samples are correctly dated. Right, we have no way of knowing that. There's no reason to assume that style was more consistent there than otherwise. So I would like to set out. There is one scholar, I believe his name is W. Wilson Good, who wrote a book on Iyov, which had two introductions. One of which was about the book, one of which was about the history of the book, and with what I think is it really, I forgot to record. with admirable clarity, he entitled the first one a dispensable introduction, without the history of the various parts of the book. So we're going to set out on the methodological assumption that the book is a unity. If one chooses to believe that, must mean that it is a redacted unity, and because the same people are not capable of writing poetry and prose, that is your privilege. But I'm going to work on the assumption that to understand the book properly, you have to find something which explains both the poetry and the prose. And in the context of the course, I'm hoping that in 2 weeks we'll come to the conclusion not only could the same person write poetry and prose, but there was something accomplished by having the book written in poetry separately. Okay. Now, there are a couple of things that need to be said. One is that the poetry is very modern in a particular sense, in that no one understands what it says, which poses a challenge to understanding it. We don't understand the words, and Sefer Iyov is, I think, unusual among books of Tanakh, although I don't trust my Bikias really, in that sarcasm and irony are a primary mode of conversation. Sefer Iyov does parody, which aside from like really vicious mockery of idolatrous prophets, mockery as such is not common in biblical texts, and that means pretty self-mockery in a sense. Parody means you have a sense of self-parody as well. So whereas we understand it's a joke when we say that in the Ten Commandments, what God really meant was lo tirtzach, lo tinaf, right? And really, he meant lo tirtzach, right? We're pretty clear. That's what he meant. And most of Tanakh is pretty clear that way also, although there is no punctuation. Right? We understand pretty well when we think somebody is being incredulous, right? when somebody is mocking, when they're saying an absolute statement. Sefer Iyov is not that way. On Sefer Iyov, it is very difficult from verse to verse to tell whether somebody is saying something as a declarative statement or as a parody of the same declarative statement. We know there are particular cases where it's evident. For example, the pasuk from Tehillim, right? Moenosh kisis gerenu, aven adam kitzif gedenu, right? What is man that thou art mindful of him, right? You know, but you had, right, but you have made him less than God. And Eov, this becomes, what are human beings that you bother afflicting them, right? You know, use the same to Zachar Pakad. All right, it's pretty clear that pasuk in Eov is making fun of Tehillim in a very sharp way, which you have in other places. You have Chitesu Chitechem, Chitechem Lecharavot, right? And in Micha, I think it is, but it's really all over Eov, right?
Yoel,
sorry, thank you. Right, you have it. We have it. Right, we have it else, but in Eov is much more common to the point that I think it is chapter 28, that if you read two different translations, one of them is entitled "The Hymn to Wisdom" and the other one is entitled "The Hymn Against Wisdom." And tell which way Joel is doing change, right? Change one thing. Therefore, it seems to me that in order to construct an interpretation of this book, it is not necessarily the wisest thing to do it on the basis of saying that one knows what it says. But that poses an interesting challenge as to how to offer an interpretation of a book without claiming to understand what any of it says. I'm going to attempt that tonight. And particularly to offer an interpretation in which the poetry plays a central role without in any way claiming to understand the poetry. Okay, that's the challenge we're setting up. Okay, another thing that needs to be said is that Eov is, of course, fairly explicitly a book about an issue, which is not as clear in other books of Tanakh. The books of Tanakh tend to be the records of what someone thought, right, what they said, particularly historically. Eov is about an issue. I leave aside the question of whether Eov is a fictional character, Eov is a historical character and this happened, or the intermediate position that Eov was a historical character about whom this is a fiction. Right, the in favor of saying that Eov is a historical character is that he is mentioned with Daniel and Noach in Yecheskel as in this list of historical figures. So that seems to imply it's historical. On the other hand, that may be a literary reference, and sometimes in a culture, literary figures are every bit as real, right, as historical figures. On the other hand, there are things in the narrative that militate against it being real. So I'm gonna bracket that question of whether it happened or not. The Rambam took the position that it was obviously a fiction, and that's, you know, from a theological perspective, I'm happy to rely on him. From a literary perspective, it seems to me that's obviously true also. But again, it can be historical fiction about somebody who's real or historical fiction about somebody who's not. Okay. Now, what is the issue? The issue is usually framed as why bad things happen to good people. And there is a temptation to address the question of why bad things happen to good people, and having come to the proper conclusion about that, to then assume that since this is the proper conclusion and Tanakh is infallible, therefore Sefer Eov must endorse the position to which one has come about why bad things happen to good people. And the temptation always is to read Sefer Eov in order to find one's theology, as opposed to approaching the book in and of itself. A temptation to which I will almost certainly fall prey tonight. I want to set that up, and I'm actually going to begin, you know, by openly acknowledging, which I usually don't do, is I'm going to start by reading Chazal. To make, to some degree, explicit what my theological biases are, and then we'll actually approach. I read, and this is the first Makor, Brachot Das Nayim Aleph, which is perhaps my favorite Gemara. I have lots of favorite Gemaras, I suppose. So, V'yomer Rabbi Yochanan Mishum Rabbi Yossi, Shloshat Rin Bikesh Moshe Lifnei HaKadosh Baruch Hu V'Natan Lo. Right, Moshe asked three things of God, and God gave them all to him. Bikesh Shetishre Shechinat L'Yisrael V'Natan Lo Shne'emar HaLo B'Lechtecha Imanu. Okay, he asked for the divine presence to rest on Israel, and it was given to him. Fine. Okay. Bikesh Shelo Tishre Shechinat L'Mot Olam V'Natan Lo Shne'emar V'Niflinu Ani V'Amcha. This is not one of my favorite lines. And try to figure out what it means and why one would ask specifically to have divine presence removed from others. Not clear to me, but tonight we're not going to get into that one. Okay, 3. V'keish lo hodiyo drachav shel HaKadosh Baruch Hu v'natan lo shenemar hodiyeni na'at derechecha. Okay, the last thing is that Moshe asked to know the drachim of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and we're going to find out in a moment. That means he wants to know how it is that God runs the world in such a way that there is justice. I'll point out that there is an ongoing theme in Chazal that this is the issue that most concerns. I don't understand why this is particularly. There doesn't seem really to be anything in Moshe's era.
Mm-hmm. could skew it in a way that seems
unfair. Well, so Moshe, that's an interesting thing. So you might be bothered by, and other contexts have talked about this, why good things happen to bad people.
Why good things happen to some people and not others.
Uh-huh.
That's totally
Isn't that what we were talking about last week with Yonah? With the rescue person's complex?
I suppose that's true. That could be. That's interesting. Okay. So Moshe says, Ribono Shel Olam, okay, now in case you've ever wondered, so God gives him the answer, so we don't have to worry about this anymore. Amarlo, Moshe, Tzadik v'tovlo, Tzadik ben Tzadik. Tzadik v'ralo, Tzadik ben Rasha. Rasha v'tovlo, Rasha ben Tzadik, Rasha v'ralo, Rasha ben Rasha. Okay. If any of you ever wondered why bad things happen to good people, it's because they have bad parents. And why good things happen to bad people, it's because they have good parents. Well, I think you know, children is a separate issue, because children are neither good or bad people. You know, children are, you know, sometimes for shock value, I'll say actually that the problem is much less of the suffering of children, because there isn't an issue of anything deserved at that point. But it's actually a more serious problem theologically with adults and with adults. But all the, you know, the reasonably good people you know who occasionally have bad things happen to them, it's only because of their parents. Okay, so this would be, right, this would be a great place to end the Gemara. And that's the end of the statement of Yochanan Mishum Rabbi Yossi, but the Gemara chooses to take this up. And it says, Omar Mar, Tzadik v'tovlo, Tzadik v'tzadik, Tzadik v'ralo, Tzadik ben Rasha. Ain't it? No, that can't be true. V'yaktiv, poked avon avod al banim, uktiv avonim layim tu al avod, v'raminan kroya hadari, v'mishanin lo kasha, hakish ochazin maseh avateim b'yadeim, hakish ein mochazin avateim b'yadeim. So this is a marvelous rabbinic thing, right, that there's a contradiction between two psukim as to whether God afflicts the sins of the parents on the children. I know that in NYU this was an early assignment when you were in graduate work in Tanakh, reconcile all the psukim in Tanakh about whether God inflicts the sins of the fathers on the children. But in one place, when the contradiction is raised, the solution is only if the afflictions of the sins of the parents are visited on the children, only if the children follow in their sins. So God.
It's not a tzaddik ben Rasha.
No. So that would be so that's not a tzaddik ben Rasha, and therefore the claim that tzaddikim suffer for their evil parents is false, because it contradicts our resolution of these psukim. So God must be wrong. Right? Remember, this was what God said to Moshe.
Or we're wrong about what God said.
Yes, you could say that, but I am particularly amused at this. Right, that this began with, and God said to Moshe, but it turns out that God couldn't have said that to Moshe. Okay. So this must be what God said to Moshe. Tzadik v'tovlo, tzadik gamor. Tzadik v'ralo, tzadik she'eno gamor. Rasha v'tovlo, rasha she'eno gamor. Rasha v'ralo, rasha gamor. Now this has the advantage of being unfalsifiable. right? Because nobody knows. Nobody knows who can claim that he's a perfectly righteous person. Right? This is an advantage. But what I always, you know, what always most gets me about this Gemara is, so what are we trying to recreate? We're trying to write, when Moshe says, Har'ini not, Har'ini not Shrochecha, right? So we're talking about the moment of Moshe's ultimate revelation, right? He's up at Har Sinai, right? Face to face with God. And and obviously this is not an easy question. Why do bad things happen to good people? And and we just say, oh, but he didn't have to go up there, he could have asked us. We wouldn't be able to figure it out. Right, because obviously we don't have any record anymore of what God said to Moshe, because the first attempt, our only historical traditional record of what God said to Moshe just went out the window because it contradicted our interpretation of two psukim. So we're now making the claim that what Moshe had to go up to Sinai and ask God at the moment of ultimate revelation is something we can figure out logically, and now we figure it out.
That
we can figure out things that God. Where do you think that claim is made?
Well, it's.
Oh, I don't think those. I don't think those stories mean that at all. I think those stories say that sometimes.
Aren't they saying we can figure it out?
Oh, well, they're saying.
Right.
What they're saying is.
But it doesn't matter, because what we figure out ends up being the normative.
In terms of law.
Yeah.
But in terms of theology, that's a very direct. You know, in law, we understand that it's better to give us authority than to allow people. To claim, right? Because if we allowed a divine authority claim in law, then we would have no capacity of control, because you can have individuals who claim that God spoke to them, and they would, right, and we have no argument over them. But it doesn't apply to theology, and we don't make the claim the law is true. We make the claim the law is binding. At least that's how I read all the sugyot. We don't make truth claims. We make binding claims. Whereas here we're making a truth claim. That we know why bad things happen to good people. That seems to me a little bit more chutzpahic.
Now, are we arguing about what God said to Moshe, or are we arguing about how to interpret a record of something God said to Moshe?
Or Moshe said it.
Well, let's wait till the end of the sugya. Let's see.
Someone said it.
Okay, so here we get to, if this is my favorite sugya, this is my favorite line. We say, "Uflegid Rabbi Meir, Damar Rabbi Meir, Shtayim Nosnulu, V'achas Lo Nosnulu." Rabbi Meir took the position the third question was never answered. Shenemar v'chanoti et asher achon, afal pi sheino hagun, v'richamti et asher achem, afal pi sheino hagun, v'yomer lo tuchal lirot et panai. Right, so the Pnei Hashem is this answer, and even Moshe never got the answer. Which, when you understand, they knew Rabbi Meir in advance. The previous statement where they said, we know what the answer is, right, becomes astronomical chutzpah. Okay, so we have a fun explanation of Rabbi Meir then. Right, Tana Mishmeda Rishua ben Karcha, Kacha Marlo HaKadosh Baruch Hu L'Moshe, Kishiratziti L'Ratzita, Achshav Sh'ata Rotze Eini Rotze. Right, so God says to so the answer is that, that God said to Moshe, once upon a time I wanted to tell you. And you didn't want to hear. Now that you want to hear, I'm not going to tell you. Okay, now, when did Moshe ask? So we get to go one other thing. So this statement is a pligid Rabbi Shmuel bar Nachmanim Rabbi Yonatan. The Amar Rabbi Shmuel bar Nachmanim Rabbi Yonatan, Bishar Shalosh Zachal Shalosh, Bishar Vayester Moshe Panav Zachal Klaster Panim, Bishar Kiyare Zachal Vayirum Migeshet Eilav, Bishar Mehabit Zachal Liyutmunat Hashem Tzmunat Hashem Yabit. Okay. So it turns out that the moment of the moment at which God wanted to was the burning bush. At that point, it turns out Rabbi Meir's interpretation is that at the burning bush, Moshe looked away, ki yarei mehabit el Elohim, and God wanted him to answer, and he simply did not answer. Okay, two things to say about this sugya. Number one, how can the Talmud do this? How can the Talmud say that we can know the answer, which we have a very strong energetic opinion that even Moshe couldn't know the answer to ultimate revelation? So my suggestion in this regard is based on my own solution to a contradiction in the Rambam. In chapter 20 of section 3 of the Mor Nebuchadnezzar, Rambam says that there is no analogy whatsoever between human and absolute, right? You cannot draw any comparison. It is said v'shituf gamur, with complete... the words mean completely homonymity, right? The words are just pronounced sound the same, but they're entirely different. Okay.
I told you I could have gotten you here.
So the Rambam in Chelek Gimel Perek Chaf says this, and therefore he says, any attempt to solve a list of 8 paradoxes about God's knowledge, foreknowledge, free will, all those sorts of issues, will fail, because that's the wrong question. Because it said, even though it says God knows just like it says human being knows, that's an accident, and really it could say God blinks and human beings know. There's no comparison. And that's great. But in chapter 21, the Rambam says, here's the relationship between human knowledge and divine knowledge. God knows things the way a potter knows his clay. Human beings know things the way the consumer, right, buys the pot. And he says, on the basis of this, you can resolve 5 of the 8 contradictions. Now, what's he doing this? He just told us, last chapter, that any attempt to draw comparisons between human and divine knowledge are silly and mistaken. And so why, in the next chapter, is he trying to resolve them? So there are, of course, a number of approaches to this. The Straussians will tell you this is one of the deliberate contradictions in the Rambam, which hides his true opinion. Might be. But the position I liked as a graduate student, and still like, is that real implication of the Rambam's position, that God's knowledge is different than ours. Rambam also says God's knowledge is his essence, God has no attributes, etc., is that theological speech is impossible. Shlomo Pinnis takes this to his logical extreme, and he says the Rambam obviously is an agnostic. not possible to make the statement God is, according to the Ramos philosophy. And he's right, logically. But sometimes in life, you come to philosophic conclusions that are impossible to deal with psychologically. Right? Rama believes that the whole purpose of human existence is to talk about God. And yet he reaches the philosophy, which the logical conclusion is, that human beings can't say anything about God. That's intolerable. In situations like that, you go on. And you keep, right, and you assume that somehow there will be an answer to that question. It will be possible to philosophically justify speech about God, even though the current implications of your thought make it impossible. So what I want to suggest is that the paradox in this Gemara, which the Gemara on the one hand tells you that knowing why bad things happen to good people is the kind of thing that maybe Moshe at the moment of ultimate revelation could know, and then say, oh, but we can figure it out, is designed to symbolize that paradox. On the one hand, the really important questions like that, this question can never be known. On the other hand, it doesn't mean that you shouldn't talk about it just because it can never be known. Talmud has this paradox, on the one hand it talks blithely about it, and on the other hand it tells you we're talking blithely about something which is humanly unknowable. Right, so that's my understanding of the Rambam, and therefore I think it's my understanding of the Gemara. But I want to make one further point that this Gemara makes. Let's try and understand what is the Gemara saying when it says that God wanted to tell Moshe why bad things happen to good people at the burning bush, but no longer wished to tell him later. What's God's motive? Is this vindictive? Right. You didn't want it when I wanted, right? So right, that doesn't make so much sense. So I want to make the I want to, and secondly, that's God. What about Moshe? Why does Moshe want to know later when he doesn't want to know earlier? Right? What's his motive for looking away? If God offers him the rationale, right? God offers him an explanation. Why would you not want the explanation? Right? So now, we're in this midrashic world. It's not that he's terrified or awed, right? God's offering him this information. He's telling him what this information is. And Moshe is saying, no, thank you. I'd rather not know. So I want to offer the following suggestion. If you understand God's plan completely, which is what knowing why bad things happen to good people is, you know God's whole plan for the universe, then you cannot be in doubt as to what your responsibilities are. You understand the whole plan, you know where you fit in the plan. So now you know what you have to do. Most people have the option of saying that their choices are insignificant. It doesn't matter what I do. But Moshe, right, if he finds, right, and what's Moshe trying to argue at the right of the bush? Send somebody else. You don't need me. Right? So Moshe's whole attempt to escape depends on him not knowing. Right? If he finds, right, so therefore Moshe at that point says, I don't want to know, because if I know your plan, then I can no longer argue that I can't do it. Later on, Moshe's duty is already clear. He's already taken it on, so he wants to know now. But now God has no motive to tell him, because Moshe's already agreed. Right, so I think that's the the default setting apparently is that God doesn't want to tell human beings. There was a moment when Moshe could have had it, because God needed him, and he turns it down, and that goes away. Okay. Now, why is all this a useful introduction to Sefer Iyov, aside from the theological issue? What I want to point out is that any understanding we gain on the question of why bad things happen to good people will change our relationship to God's plan. The story of Moshe Rabbeinu is an example of how knowledge changes you. And so when we approach approach Sefer Iyov, right, which is a book apparently about why bad things happen to good people.
Changes are not always to the good.
No, not always to the good. Now, I'm open to that. But one of the issues we have to figure out is how much credence are we willing to give its answers, right? If we say, this is really what Sefer Iyov means, are we going to buy that? Okay, that's what we think. And how much would it change us to accept these answers? Okay, I want to set that up as an intro to realize that Sefer Iyov is different, perhaps, than other kinds of learning, and that you're changed by what you know. Okay, what happens in Sefer Iyov? So in the Makarot I've given you, this time I have not taken away the chapters, but you'll see I've given it out of order. So the first two pages are the prose narrative, right? His chapters 1, 2, and 42. And then the third page that I've given you is selected poetry. Okay, so just to understand the structure, the structure. So what do we know about you? So in Perek Aleph, we discover that there was a man who lived in the land of Utz, named Iyov, and that man was Tam V'yashar, V'yarei Elokim, V'sar Meira. That's who Iyov is, that's the narrator's testimony, and I'm going to assume that we don't have to worry about unreliable narrators here. Right? That it's not that modern. The narrator tells us that this is what Iyov is. Okay. The question is, does this describe somebody who is perfect or somebody who is improvable? Okay, and anyone reading these with a rabbinic eye will automatically note that the last two terms conceivably leave room for improvement. You can describe somebody as Yirei Elokim and say, gee, what happened to Ahava? Right, you can describe somebody as Sar Meira, right? You have the tune, thing in your head, right? Sar Meira, Va'aseto, oops! Where did the Aseitov go? All right, so we have two immediate axes that one can pick up. Chazal pick up on the Sar Meira in this magnificent medrash, which has Iyov described as one of the advisors to Paro. I forget who the other two are. One of them argues for the slavery, one of them argues against the slavery, and Iyov runs away. And that's what that mentor is doing, is reading this one. One of them, Haman, and I forget who the good one is.
Now,
what is Bilam? What is Bilam? What is Bilam? One is Bilam, and I forget who the good one is. I forget. But it's 1-4, 1-against, and Iyov runs away, and again, all they're doing...
Yitro,
good. Okay, right, Bilam, Yitro, and Iyov... But Iyov runs away, right? That's again the point for me in that medrash is that Iyov runs away because he's Sar Meira, but he's not a Seitov. Okay, finally, if one is a Maimonidean, so you discover that he's Tam Yashar Yirei Elokim Sar Meira, what happened to smart? Now, being smart is a moral category for the Rambam. It's not necessarily a moral category for most other people, but for the Rambam, being Chacham is a moral category. So one has three possible approaches in the opening line, assuming that the message of Sefer Iyov is to some degree going to be conveyed in a change in Iyov, if one wishes to make that assumption. So you have three axes. He can get smarter, he can love God more, or he can actively do good as opposed to just avoiding evil. So one of the interpretational questions we have to ask is, does the Sefer Iyov show him moving from not doing evil to doing good, from fearing God to loving him, or from being awed by God to loving him, and becoming a deeper intellectual? Okay. In Psukim Bet and Gimel, we discover that Iyov is rich, that he has seven sons and three his children. And his children, we find out in the rest, in verses 4 and 5, that his children live what really has to be described as the ultimate party life. Right? There are seven sons, and each of them makes a party each day. And they all get together. All the sons and all the daughters all get together and they have a party. They have a party each day. Okay, I would note that there's one axis which there is a clear development in Iyov, which is usually not taken as central to the theme, but perhaps it is that in the very beginning of Sefer Iyov, it says, right, that the seven sons each make parties in their houses and they invite the daughters to join them. But if you look at the end of Perek Mem Bet, Pasuk Ted Vav, on the second page, you'll discover that at the end of the book, Vayetein Lem Avihem Nachala B'toch Achihem. Iyov gives his daughters equal shares with the brothers, so presumably they can make their own parties from there on. Since this is perhaps the clearest change from the beginning to end of the book, one could argue that the point of the story is to teach Iyov feminism, and bad things happen to good people who aren't sufficiently feminist.
Yeah.
This may also be unfalsifiable because who among us is sufficiently feminist? But it's put as part of, you know, you can take this as you wish, but it is clear this is a development in the book. And it is certainly a deep mystery as to what the focus on the daughters is throughout the book. I don't understand it.
I don't understand anything in this book.
Okay.
Don't look at me.
Okay. At the end of a week's round of parties, or a particular week's round of parties, not clear whether this is... the text narrative is unclear as to whether they actually lived this their entire life, or it just happens that once there was a particularly good round of parties. The most likely thing is that it happened pretty often. So we discover that Eov sends, right, so we're in Pasuk now, Vayishlach Eov Vayikadashem, so Eov sends a message and he sanctifies them, we have no idea what that means. He gets up in the morning and he brings Olot, numbering all of them, Ki Amar Eov Ulai Chatu Banai, Uverchu Elokim Bilvavam, Kacha Yaseh Eov Kol Hayami. Now this is really kind of strange. All the things that one worries about one's children doing. Oh, my children who have been partying every night of the week, perhaps they cursed God in their hearts. It's a very, very strange, strange notion. You know, it could be that, you know, why should sons who are living, basically living it up on inherited wealth, right, what reason do they have to curse God? So it could be that just as you can curse God out of suffering or rebellion, you can curse God out of blasé cynicism. Maybe Eov was concerned that his sons had become jaded or they would no longer find meaning in the universe. But it seems to me more likely that this worry has to be at least partially the result of projection. Right? If Eov is worried about his sons doing this because this is something that he's worried about himself, and therefore it's possible to argue that we should look for the meaning of the book in how Eov develops himself with regard to this issue. Question of cursing God in your heart despite great wealth. Okay. What happens in the narrative next is that God tests Eov by removing first his wealth and his children and then his health. In a fascinating, really fascinating line, right in Perek Bet Pasuk Gimel, after God has given Satan permission to remove Eov's wealth and children, and now, right now, he turns to Satan. He says, "Vayomer Hashem el Hasatan, Hasamta libcha el avdi Eov ki ein kamo ba'aretz ish tam v'yashar v'yirei Elokim v'sar mira ve'odenu machazik betumato v'atisiteni vo leval ochina." That's an amazing line. Right, God accuses Satan. You have seduced me. Right, you have convinced me to swallow Eov up. Now, halachically, this is not a good excuse. Now, halachically, right, it's clear that in the story that God actually violates Hilchot Lashon Hara. One of the things you learn about Hilchot Lashon Hara is you're not allowed to say good things about people so that they can then say bad things. Right, and if you walk up to Satan and you say, "Have you seen this guy, right, my servant Eov?" Right, so what's Satan going to say? "Yes, but..." Right, so it's entirely clear that God, is doing this even the second time. Right, that God is setting it up so that Satan will ask him. So one of the questions that one really has to ask is, one assumes that God is perfectly aware when he says this to the Satan, that the reaction is going to be, "Prove it." But right, so part of the story has to be that God is challenging. Right, that God is asking the Satan to ask this question, and why would God ask the Satan if he says that to sitani vodav alochina? Why would God encourage the Satan to seduce him, to swallow Yevob for nothing? Now, I just want to point out literally here that the word chinam is not an accident. Because if you take a look in Perek Aleph, Pasuk Tet, right, when God first asks Satan, what he says is, "Vayana Satan et Hashem vayomar, hachinam yirei Eov Elokim." Okay, so it seems to me from a literary perspective, right, at least one of the central themes of Sefer Eov has to be embodied in that question, why does God, literally, why is God poter pela Satan? Right, and I think that the phrase "al tiftach pela Satan" is a straight reading of Sefer Eov. Even though it's not the context that shows up in the Gemara, it's It's just too obvious. And that, right, the answer to that question has to be wrapped up in the word chinam. Okay.
Is this the only book in which the satan's a being?
No, it shows up in Zecharia. The satan I don't even know the seat note.
Also, does he act?
No, he's just spoken to. He's spoken to. There's also, I mean, the word satan shows up in, I think, Divrei Yamim related to David. The satan with this kind of personified characteristics, right? Yeah, with one of the Elohim, etc., only shows up here.
Yeravam crazy, not Yeravam Rahabam. Three guys
could be. I mean, lisatain is a perfectly ordinary verb, but a malach who is a satan, mm-hmm. I think in Zechariah, I think in Divrei Yamim with the satan, emot satan, and he convinces David to make the census. I think it's a satan. Now again, the whole machlokes is that satan a malach, or is it mito, or is it referring to some evil person? Who knows? The satan is a fully developed character, right? Lucifer, right? Lucifer is here. Yeah. Everyone is all. Okay. So much fun that people get named Ben Shachar now. Like, it depends on, you know, which way you read the Ben Pasuk. Okay. So now let's take a look at what Eov actually does. So Eov responds to the first affliction in Perek Aleph Pasuk Chaf Aleph. He says, "Vayomer Arom Yetzati Mibeten Imi." Ve'arom ashuv shama, Hashem natan v'Hashem lakach, yishem Hashem yivarach. On which the narrator says, "B'lchol zot lochata Iyov, v'nantan tifla leloki." Okay, so he gives that response, and the narrator endorses his response. The second time, which is in Perek Bet pasuk Yud. This is after Iyov's wife tries to get him to say Barech Elokim v'meit. And there again is the Barech Elokim, which is the temptation. So he reacts angrily to her, and he says, "Kedaver achat hanevelot davari, gam et hatov nekabel meit Elokim, et haral nekabel." On which the narrator comments, "Bechol zot luchata Iyov bisfatav." Something changes. Now we can take it as we can take this as meaning. Bechol zot luchata Iyov bisfatav as meaning that we are simply being given psychological insight. There is no substantive difference between the way Eov responds in Perek Aleph and the way Eov responds in Perek Bet, and therefore the narrator has to tell us, by the way, the first time he didn't sin at all, the second time he only didn't sin with his lips. Something changed internally. That's a less satisfying approach to me than to say that Bechol zot luchata Eov bisfatav, meaning Eov is a sar meira. He's not going to say things that are sins. That doesn't mean that you can't see in what he doesn't say. Right, a psychological shift. And so the knowledge that Eov is moving towards being Mevarech Hashem Bilvavo, right, must be somewhere contained in that shift. Okay, and the shift to me is that in the first version, Eov says, the default setting is that I have nothing. Right? That's it. And therefore, when God takes away, all he's doing is saying, you know, you're back. Right? You know, it's taking away what I had no right to have with me. In the second parak, Eov says, God does good and God does evil. If we accept the good, we have to accept the evil also. That's a very different claim. Right? It doesn't mean that I have no claim on God. It just means that on balance, God comes out okay. And so my suggestion is that this is what the narrator sees as the sin of Eov in his heart, is that shift. Because in the first version, nothing could change Eov's opinion. If you assume that you deserve nothing, then the worst that happens to you, you're just, you know, whatever, you know, you're alive, you're at zero until you die. You die, you get back to zero. But in the second version, it could be that the Ra will end up outweighing the Tov. Right now, right, we accepted the Tov and now we accept the Ra. But a week from now, it's been a lot longer and these boils are really painful. Now the Ra outweighs the Tov. Right? So eos, Christ, eos, theological shift, is a dramatic thing. Okay, now we have to ask. So Eov at this point makes the claim that there is Tov and there is Ra, and the Tov outweighs the Ra. Is he right?
Happy to take things you have to take. Happy to take whatever you say. Even if it's worse than... you sign on and then you take whatever...
Okay, you could take the... You could take that understanding as well, that he is just saying, you know, we bought into this and now we're stuck. But how much are you stuck with, right? You're stuck to a bargain forever, right? If I take $10 from you, does that mean that I have to lend that, right, that I have to lend you money, you know, even if you bankrupt me for the rest of my life? That doesn't seem fair either. He didn't have a choice about taking the good either. God gave it to him, so it's not such a convincing argument either. Oh, he could have burned his field, but you know that would have been ingratitude, right? And we would have gotten in for that.
He donated it to charity.
Even that, you know, if you give all your goods to charity, that might also be ingratitude. And then somebody else, then you're just sticking somebody else with the good.
Poor sucker.
Yeah, right. So then they're stuck accepting that, right? I don't know. Okay, so I want to hold that shift. I want to move from that to pointing out a structural claim which should be familiar from last week's article. Right. So we said that we don't know the content of the poetry in any significance. Argue that there are some spaces, right, where we do understand a little bit of the poetry. Let's take a look at some of the poetry. So if you take a look in Perek Dalet, and it's basically, you know, the poetry is structured as there are three rounds, maybe it's just two, of the three friends each speaking. At the end of the last round, a new character named, the three friends initially, they come, and they offer their consolations, which are almost all direct attacks on Eov. Eov responds. A new person named Elihu gets mad at them because they haven't convinced him. He gives a speech. Then God comes in and gives a speech. Eov responds. God gives another speech. Eov responds. Then we get back to the narrative. Okay. The basic theme of all the speeches, as I see it, again, there are lots of sophisticated attempts to tease particular philosophic ideas out of particular prakim, is contained in Perek Aleph Pasuk Yud Zayin, in the speech of Eliphaz HaTemani. Right, Einosh me'elo akid stak im me'hosevi targaver hein davadav lo yamin v'malachav yasim tahala. Can man be more just than God? After all, God doesn't trust anybody. It's very interesting, and you'll see that that plays out all the way through. So in Perek Tet, I give you Eov's response to a letter speech really fast, which is Amno yadati kichein u'mayid stak enoshim kel. But this, of course, is sarcastic. Right. This is Eov more saying, which is one of his themes, that I might be more just than God, but who would be the judge? There's no courtroom in which I can prove my justice. So my yitzdak here does not mean who will be more just. It means who will come out ahead in court. And then again, Eliphaz responds, "My nosh ki yizkeh, v'chi yitzdak yiludisha, hein biktoshav l'yamin v'shamayim l'zaku beinav." Right. Human beings can't do this. In Elihu's speech in Lamed Bet, right? So Lamed Bet Bet, Vayichar Af Elihu Ben Brachel Uzi Mishpachat Ram Biyov Chara Po Al Tzadko Nafsho Me'elukim. Okay, Lamed Hey Bet, Elihu again, Hazot Chashavti LeMishpat Amarti Tzidki Me'el. Okay, so I'm going to make the claim that at core you can boil down. But all...
I like
Who's
the name.
Pardon?
I like his name.
Yes. Yeah, they're all interesting. Eliphaz is also an interesting, right, interesting name in Jewish history. I don't have much to say about that. You know, that needs... Obviously, I am taking the cheap way out by not interpreting the poetry, just claiming that there's one theme which is that, and that'll be enough for us tonight, and later we can, right? Okay. Now, there are many discussions as to what the friends say. There is, however, one thing. Actually, before I get to, let me point out a number of other things. Okay, so then, Eov in Perek Lamed Chet responds to God, and he said, God talks to Eov in Lamed Chet after Elihu's speech, and Eov's response in Perek Mem is Vayan Hashem et Eov. So Eov, Hashem says to Eov, Harov im Shaddai Yisor Mochiach Eloai Yanena. Right? Is it really a good idea to argue with God? So which Eov responds, Hein Kaloti Ma'ashivecha Yodai Samti L'Mofi Achas Dibarti V'lo Ne'ene. I'm not going to talk anymore. Oh, you're right. You win. To which God gives yet another speech, which is what all of Perek Mem Aleph, right? And Perek Mem Aleph, and Eov has to respond again, and this time it's a much more elaborate speech, right? Perek Mem Bet. Yadati ki lo tuchal lo beter mecham ki kol tuchal lo beter mecham izima, right? Mize malim etzab lidat lochen yigati v'lo avin niflo nimeni v'lo ida. Shmana v'nechad aberesh l'chavod yeni, right, I listen to you, right, l'shem ya'ozim shmaticha v'ata ini ro'atcha, al kenim as v'nichamti al afar v'efer. Okay. One approach to this, right, and this is a very classic beat of the whole book, is in Mem Bet Hei, l'shem ya'ozim shmaticha v'ata ini ro'atcha. Before I had just heard of you, now I have seen you, and in fact, God's response has no substance into it. God's response is just, who are you? And Eov says, you're right. You know, now that you make the argument, now that I see you, you're right. Who am I? And he just goes away. It's built on that line, L'shema ozen shmaticha v'ata eini ra'atcha. To a contemporary non-from ears, that is not a very happy answer, or even from ears, we have two really fun responses to this, to the problem. And what they basically say is, on the structural claim, I like structural arguments, Eov gives in after the first thing God says. Then God talks again. Why? So you have two fun readings here, one by Elie Wiesel and one by William Sapphire. Elie Wiesel argues that Eov understands he can't win the argument. If he tries to argue, he's just going to end up, you know, God's going to keep on battering it and battering it and battering him. When you're in an argument you can't win, the best tactic you have is to agree right away in a way that everyone knows is fake. And so Eov just gives in, and God goes on again. Eov says, I gave it already, whatever you want. Eov says, I already said up front, there's no judge, there's no jury that can evaluate this case. And so the whole thing, right, and so the whole thing is, right, it's just Eov saying, you know, I'm preserving my right to argue some other time, you can't convince me. Sapphire points out a more difficult moral problem, which is the narrative at the end says, okay, so Eov lost his sons and his daughters and all his money, so God gives him back sons and daughters and money. God gave us the good, he took us the bad, we're back to where we started. When you assume that you start off with children, God takes them away, he gives you back different children, that doesn't get you back where you started. All right, so Sapphire argues that really, the book is supposed to end. I give in to power, I'm intimidated. It's right, there's no hope talking. But the editor came along and said, we're never going to sell the book this way. People like happy endings. But the writer said, no, you know, it's against the integrity of the book. Right? So they agreed to make up a ridiculous ending. Right? Which only the kind of people who wouldn't buy a book, which ends, right, with God winning my brute power, can succeeding. Okay. It's clever, it's fun. But again, I like to reinterpret the book as a whole. So that doesn't really do it for me. Either. Okay, so what really is going on in the book? So the one thing that seems universally agreed about the poetic section is that there is one explanation for Eov's suffering that is not mentioned. Several are mentioned. Eov sinned, Eov would have sinned. The one thing that is not mentioned is that Eov is suffering because God made a bet with Satan. That's the one thing that's not mentioned. Any notion that suffering ennobles is mentioned. But the notion that Eov is being tested so that God can prove something, does not show up. And that leads to a disconnect between the poetry and the prose. Right, the prose tells us what actually happened. What actually happened is that guy, right, that the Satan said, "Look, is God is the overly hakinam yireiv elokim?" And God said, "I don't know. Go prove it." So I have to ask, right, assuming we don't take a reductionist perspective, why does one write a book in which the poetry mentions every possibility except the one in the prose? The answer to this, I think, is found in a poem by Robert Frost. Robert Frost wrote a poem about Eov called The Mask of Reason, which has a number of really fun lines, particularly really, really fun interpretation of Aishas Eov, who gets to have all the answers. Why is it that men are prophets and women are witches? Why is it that men are prophets and women are witches? And she has a whole lot of other complaints along this line. But
you mean the same behavior gets
changed? Yeah, that's her claim. That's her claim. But there are a lot of fun things in the book. But there's one moment in which I think Frost solves, and I should say that many academics have taken this as the proof that the poetry and the prose must be written by different people, because look, poetry doesn't know anything about the prose. So Frost has a dialogue between God and Eov, which I think just absolutely nails it. It goes as follows. "Too long I have owed you an apology," says God speaking, "for the apparently unmeaning sorrow you were afflicted with in those old days. It was the essence of the trial. You shouldn't understand it at the time. It had to seem unmeaning to have meaning." Frost argues is that the moment that it is suggested to Eov that what he is undergoing is a nisayon, bam. Because anybody with any sense knows that if you pass the test, God will reward you. So the core of the book is about Eov's response on the assumption that he cannot possibly know the real answer. Now that, first of all, is an amazing metaphor again for this question. We started off with the Gemara, which talks about our approaching even though we can't know the answer. So that's what Eov. Right? Eov is somebody. Right. The whole meaning of the bad thing that happens to the good people is that the good people can't know why the bad thing happens. That's stage one. So the test only works so long as no one considers the possibility that poetry and the prose actually work together beautifully. Possibly one explanation of the shift is, right, you have to know that you're moving away from a universal... Now the question we can ask now is, what's the test about? Well, the test is about Hachinam Yareya Eov Elokim. We can now ask, should Eov fear God for nothing? Is that a fair thing for God to ask a human being?
What does it mean to fear for nothing?
You have no expectation that you will be compensated.
For
fearing God. Right? Obedience, all the things that stem from fear. Right? Satan says to God...
But at the same time, you, as in here where the Ahava, etc. are left out, that universe, or is it a more generalized... I mean, most people...
Okay, because let me push it one step further.
Right? Because you're...
Okay, good. Right, so let me push it one step further. Nobody who believes in God's justice can demonstrate that they fear God for nothing. Because if you believe in God's justice, then you have to assume, right, that your obedience will be compensated.
Well, if you believe in God, you can't demonstrate it either.
That's true. If you believe,
it's not just believing in God's justice.
Well, maybe and maybe not, because what I want, right, because justice and love are different things.
Yeah.
You can love without having any consequential aspect. I would argue that love doesn't necessarily entail love God for who He is, and that doesn't necessarily
the consequential aspect.
Yes,
that's a consequence, though.
Yeah, but I don't. If I love God, I don't necessarily expect to be rewarded for loving God. It is not
but
a necessity.
I have an acceptance that I wouldn't have.
That's true. So I want to.
I guess one could say that love is its own reward.
Yes.
In a way that fear is not.
Right. But so I want to argue is that Satan's question to God essentially is, does anybody love you? Right? Since all those people who know you believe that you are just, right? Everybody, every time somebody does anything for you, right? They're doing it knowing full well that you'll punish them if you don't, and you reward them if you do. So you have no way of knowing whether anybody serves you chinam. And that's what the right, that's what the whole test is. So the whole narrative of Sefer Iyov is about whether God can ever know that any human, right, any being, right, serves him out of love. Right, hin b'kdoshav lo yamin. Right, v'malachav yasim ta'ala. Right, that they, right, that they, the poetry frames it very starkly. When the Satan, right, and the Satan has a legitimate challenge to God. Right, you have, right, and you have no way of knowing. Now, the truth is, this is a challenge that can only be made once, because once we have the book, it's over. Right, it's not all of us, right, all of us know the possibility of an Nisayon. We've read the book. Right, so the truth is, right, the truth is that, right, that the answer. The dialogue between Satan and God is one of the things that's, you know, that kibyachol is unknowable to God also, right? Because there is no, right? Because there is no way, right? There's the artificiality of the poetry is that no one ever thinks of this possibility. Publishing the book means that it's impossible now. Okay, so that, it seems to me, is a, is...
And that was the wisdom of...
Well, I don't know, with wisdom of publishing the book or not, you know, maybe, you know, there is, for one of the things is, right, is that Chazal suggests that Moshe Rabbeinu wrote the book, which is part of the same theme, you know, it's a Kishrei Tziti L'Ratzita, right, now Moshe comes along, right, and makes them, right, and exposes it to everybody, right, so we can have a further dialogue in that regard. I don't know. I don't know.
It's not possible anymore for God to find out.
But now we have the question, right? So now we have
that would be a good reason to publish.
Or we talked about this when I dealt with this in the I taught this as a sample high school class in England this past spring, dealing with part of this question. That one of the arguments of the book seems to be that if bad things never happen to good people, if we lived in a world in which reward and punishment were evident, then love of God would be impossible. Love of God requires the possibility that we're... A version of this argument is made by Jorge Luis Borges in a short story called The Lottery of Babylon, in which he sets up a world in which there's originally Karv Onesh, and eventually people deliberately introduce it, the lottery, because they can't live a life in which they know everything is exactly ordered. But I want to suggest that one of the things Sefer Iyov tells us is that the reason bad things happen to good people is not because of anything associated with a mythic person. Right? The scent, right, because Iyov is in fact not somebody who deserves anything bad happening to them. But there has to be a possibility, otherwise, right, otherwise, not only God doesn't know, but we don't know. We have no way of knowing what our motives are, because you can't disentangle. You can't disentangle your motives. If you know perfectly well when you engage in this act, that this act will be rewarded. You know perfectly well when you fail to engage in that act, that act will be punished. Right, the act would be punished otherwise. On what sense can you know your own motives? So I think, right, this is my own argument, that that when one understands the way in which Sefer Iyov is structured, and the key structural element is that Iyov's purpose, right, you understand that a certain, move from that to the argument that a certain degree of ignorance doesn't matter in the end whether bad things happen to good people for good reasons or bad reasons. Right? The point is, we have to not know. The moment we know that things happen, then we become, right, we become beings who function purely, right, on the basis of schar v'onesh. Right. We could rebel, right, we know if we rebel, right, we can be, we know, right, we know that, that we're doing bad. But if we behave, never know. Certainly not us, and maybe not God. And the purpose of a Nisayon is that God actually finds out how human beings choose under free will. Okay, that's my, right, that's my reading of all of Sefer Iyov. I want to throw in a couple of points though about the rest of the book, which are not mine, which hopefully will tie in. If we take a look at the,
it's not terribly flattering of God, is it? God's self, the people, and that they're, I mean, because just. Or unless you take the extra step in saying it's actually a gift to humanity,
absolutely,
to allow us to stretch, because otherwise God wouldn't be giving us the opportunity to stretch into love of God.
Absolutely.
It would be a no-brainer.
Right.
But overall, there is a little bit of a pawns on the chessboard.
Okay, good. So
that setup.
Right. So that reading, Robert Heinlein has a science fiction novel called Job, a Comedy of Justice, in which he takes your perspective exactly. You know, he makes it literally a bet, right, between God and his older brother. Right, and he deals with it that way. I think that the move exactly that has to be made is that you have to work on the assumption of the book is that Ahavat Hashem is the greatest gift God can give to humanity. And similarly, right?
Yeah,
and
God loving us, us loving
both, right? In what relationship?
Giving us the potential.
Right. The potential to love and be loved. Right? And love only grows, right? Right? Love only happens if it's, right, if there's a possibility, right? If there's a possibility of return. So yeah, I think that's the argument one has to make, is that God has to set up a universe in which it is possible for human beings to love him, and in which it's possible God can't love the angels. I think the argument is love is a product of free will, and free will is a product of at least the experience of randomness.
But you wouldn't think he would.
That's just most of the time. It's just part of God.
That doesn't bother me so much.
Eternal dialogue.
Hazan is there to point out, right, what God's Yetzer Hara is, Kaviv Yachol, right? And the Yetzer Hara God has is that he doesn't believe that anybody's, right? He has no reason to believe that anybody serves him out of love. And the whole purpose of the creation.
But that's sort of a despair on his part. God despairs at that point.
In a sense, right? In a sense, you know, that's where, you know, God says the only way I can do this, right, in this narrative, right, is I take this one perfect being, right, you know, who's been set up his whole life to live in a world where everything is perfect, and then take everything away. And I think religiously it can be very powerful if one understands, you know, depends on whether one is comfortable using traditional language about God. So the contemporary Orthodox Jewish philosopher who is best at this is Michael Visegrad. About whom hopefully one of these days tradition, which has only been sitting and proofreading for a year and a half now. But I have hopes that it will eventually come out. In non-Orthodox circles, this is usually identified with Abram Joshua Heschel. I think there are real differences between what Heschel and Visegrad. But I think that's part of the question. Is one comfortable talking about Visegrad says very straightforwardly.
The Rambam wouldn't.
Probably not. Although I'm more leery about making claims like that of the Rambam. But Visegrad explicitly takes on the Rambam. That's his claim. And he says that one can attribute to God Eros as well as Agape. And Eros is desire. Right? Right? Love, right? And which Maimonides are very uncomfortable with because that implies a lack in God. I think that Visegrad is true to Midrashic tradition. That God creates human beings because account for that very well. Again, as pointed out in the very beginning, the Rambam doesn't account for much very well. In a very deep philosophic sense, because the Rambam basically makes all theology impossible. Right? So that's deeply problematic for me. So I'm willing to say this is one of the gaps the Rambam would have gotten through, since the Rambam does talk very much about emotional yearning for God. Right? So I'm willing to say that he might have found a way around that. Okay, so in the last 3 minutes, are kind of, I wanted to point out that there is... There is one other narrative structure at the end of the book which really need to be addressed. So in Perek Membet, Membet Zayin says, Vahi achar diber Hashem et advarim ha'ele el Yov, Vayom Hashem alifat ha'temani, chara api v'cha u'vishnei re'echa, ki lo debartam elai nechona ke'avdi Yov. Okay, so now the boring way of reading this, of course, is that Yov's ending was finally the good stuff, right? But it's not clear that Eov's ending has any new content in it. It's not in the previous speeches. So that's a weak reading, although it follows sequentially. The exciting modern reading, which one else has to figure out whether that's too projective, is Eov, by challenging God and accusing him of injustice, right, it was in fact much more accurate about what was happening, which was in fact unjust. And God does not wish people to assume that everything he does is just, because in a world in which everyone assumes everything he does is just, no one can love him. Right, so therefore, right, God praises Eov because Eov, by being open to the possibility of injustice, also opens the possibility of genuine relationship with God. Okay, that's neat. But it goes on. So right, God tells them, "Ve'ata kechulachem shiva parim v'shiva ilim l'chul avdi Eov halitem olah badchem v'Eov avdi yitpalel aleichem ki im panav esal avilti asot imchen nevala ki lo divarti elai nechona ki avdi Eov." Okay, you guys all got it wrong. You guys all got it wrong. So Eov needs to pray for you. And then in Pasuk Yud Aleph, Pasuk Yud, So they go and they do it, and Pasuk Yud, Hashem shav et shvut Iyov b'hitpalalo be'ad re'ehu. Now that's wrong. It should be that God forgives the re'im. But instead it's Hashem shav et shvut Iyov. Right, it's palalo be'ad re'ehu. So this, I think, is, and then, v'yavoi lav kolecha v'cholachiyoto v'chol yodav v'fanav, and everybody comes and meets him. So very, pardon?
Iyov has a cheap, genuine relationship.
Ah, very good. So the first thing I want to say, this is not my insight. In Kol HaDidyo Fake, which is now published as Fate and Destiny, this is one of the great moments the Rav has. Right, in which he says, look, if you read the book, right, Iyov, right, the point of Sefer Iyov is not achieved. Iyov doesn't actually grow until the moment that he prays for others. Right, and so he argues that, what Iyov had lacked is his capacity to see himself as part of a community, and he takes the same thing. You know, when Iyov runs away, right? It's just, well, he's preserving his own integrity, but he's not actually taking responsibility for others. But I want to take the point that you made, right, which I think is even stronger, which is, what does Iyov do? Up until now, we can assume that Iyov's relationship with his friends were like his relationship with God. He did things to them for them because they did things to him, for him. Now his friends have let him down. They've accused him of sinning because they can't face a world in which God behaves arbitrarily. Now how does Iyov react to them? If at the end of the day Iyov's relationships with human beings are on the assumption that I only have to do for them so long as they're for me, then he hasn't learned anything. Right? So We don't know if, since Iyov's response to God is so shut off, right? And we don't know if Iyov ever achieves Ahavat Elokim, because that's a lot to deal with in the end, right? But what we do find out in the end is that Iyov, without God telling him he has to, right? And without God ever doing anything for him now, because still, God still has not done anything for him at this point. His friends come to him and say, you know, we got it wrong. Right? We're afraid that God will do something to us. And Iyov could say, okay, well, God will do something to you. You know, God does stuff to me, God does stuff to you. Right? Why should I care? Iyov prays for them. And then, all his relatives who had abandoned him in the beginning, right, in Perek Bet, they all run away. Right? And Iyov could look at them and say, get away. I don't need you. Right? But they all come. Right, by right, they eat in his house as Yudalev, vayinachemu oto al kol ha'ra'ah shrei v'yashem alav, and they are capable of consoling him in a way they couldn't console him previously. He still needs consolation, because after all, his children still died. Right, he still needs consolation, but now he's capable of receiving consolation from people whom he understands may not be able to give him as much as he can give them. If that's correct, and actually the whole book ties together, where the whole theme of Sefer Iyov is that the capacity for love is a product of the absence of justice. Rachamim and Ahava, are necessarily connected, and that the way in which Iyov grows is in his capacity to achieve relationship. And one understands that just as that the basis for relationships among human beings is the same as the basis for relationships with God, which is the capacity to do things that will not be requited. Sure.
Midrash.
Sure, and that's right.
Really.
Sure, and they're playing off the same idea, and Iyov is assimilated to Noah. You had a question a long time ago.
How the book can only be published as on a global scale, natural culmination of love is the entering into a covenant. And once you enter into a covenant, then you don't have...
That's true. That's a good question.
So I wonder how that relates to the Iyov and Moshe.
Aha, that's interesting. That's an interesting question.
You know, what happens between when I was willing and then when you were willing if the Moshe was lost?
That's an interesting notion. And I always talk at weddings about how, you know, the Hava and Halacha has to be embodied in law.
Right.
I guess the
greatest thing of is to put yourself in a position. Can't do it anymore.
Right. Now I think that's my usual wedding speech. Mm-hmm. And that's interesting as to how that's a cool dichotomy which I need to explore further. Okay, I have a shtick to end, if I'm interested.
Can I just ask a minor question from the very beginning? You're smart or not?
Yeah.
Is there anywhere in Tanakh where a person is characterized Halel having
But
certainly none of like the guys who we think of as being defined as great. Abraham, Yelavot, no. Like, it's not an adjective that we...
That's true. You know, that's the Rambam's reading.
So it's very interesting. Shlomo, or that he would expect.
Shlomo is
Shlomo, right, that's true.
So the shtick I have is that many years ago, I guess now, it would be 19 years ago. I wrote a poem, which won a contest at YU, although it had no it is not a, as opposed to some of my poetry, I think is really quite good. This was a pre-talents poem, where I didn't know how to write, but I think it sort of makes the point. But I wrote it better in Hebrew many years later, and I lost the only copy. But this is the English version. It was called "Hainosh Me'elok Yitzdak." The first verse is "Lament of a Morning Angel." My job, we did not wish this upon you. For the days of your life, we apologize. For the lives of your children, we weep. And we too wish for understanding. Second verse is the prayer of the healed Eov. God, I did not bring this upon myself. The days of my life were filled with righteousness. The lives of my children were dedicated to you. Yet for your revelation, I am grateful. Last stanza is the psalm of the healing God. Job, I brought this upon you. For the days of your life, I will not apologize. For the lives of your children are mine. Yet I am grateful for your understanding.